almost half of planet Earth, belongs to absolutely no one.
Yeah, it's wild to think about.
It really is. It's like this massive, incredibly vulnerable Wild West. But today, for your deep dive, we are looking at a really fascinating paper from the journal Marine Policy. And it basically suggests that the only way to save this unregulated frontier isn't with, more satellite data or stricter spreadsheets.
Right.
It's with science
It
fiction.
is a wildly unconventional approach to a very serious problem. The paper we're looking at is called The Living Infinite, Envisioning Futures for Transformed Human-Nature Relationships on the High Seas.
Quite a mouthful.
Yeah, it is. But the researchers argue something really profound. They're saying we are never going to fix the largest ecosystem on our planet until we fundamentally change how we imagine it.
Okay, let's unpack this because I promised you science fiction, and we are absolutely going to get into rogue nanobots, talking microbes, and gene pirates.
Yes, the gene pirates are my favorite part.
Right. But to understand why a room full of serious, data-driven marine scientists felt forced to start writing sci-fi, we first have to understand the mind-boggling scale of the political nightmare they're trying to solve. We are talking about the high seas, or, what international law calls areas beyond national jurisdiction.
Right. And just think about the pure geography for a moment. These areas make up over 64% of the global ocean.
Wow, over 60%.
Yeah, that translates to more than 45% of the entire surface of our planet. So it is a space that, legally speaking, belongs to no single nation, which unfortunately, historically, has meant it belongs to whoever has the biggest boat and the longest nets.
Yeah, and that mentality didn't just appear out of nowhere, right? It's basically baked into the DNA of how we interact with the ocean.
Exactly. That historical mindset is built on a legal concept called Mare Liberum, or the open sea. And this was formulated way back in 1609.
Wait, 1609? That's over 400 years ago.
Yeah, back then, the ocean seemed terrifying and infinite and completely inexhaustible. So the idea was that the seas should be free for everyone to navigate and exploit. And I mean, that made sense when exploitation just meant wooden sailing ships catching a few fish.
Sure, catching a few cod, not scraping the ocean floor.
Right. But applying a 1609 philosophy to the 21st century, where we have massive factory ships and deep sea mining robots and global plastic pollution, it's turned the high seas into a tragic free-for-all.
So if a massive factory ship is out in the middle of the Pacific, thousands of miles from land, just strip mining the ecosystem, who actually writes the rules to stop them?
Well, currently, no one central authority does. The governance is this highly fragmented patchwork of sectoral management bodies. So you have one international organization managing shipping routes.
Okay.
Then you have a completely different one managing specific types of fishing, and yet another looking at seabed mining.
It just sounds like a complete bureaucratic maze.
It's a nightmare. And these organizations operate using consensus-based decision making, which is one of those phrases that sounds lovely and democratic on paper, but is actually a disaster in
Oh,
practice.
I totally get that. It feels exactly like a terrible college group project. The
Oh,
one.
absolutely, the worst kind.
Yeah, where you have this massive assignment saving the global ocean, basically, and absolutely nothing gets done because one single person in the group can just veto every good idea.
That analogy perfectly captures the dysfunction, honestly. In these international negotiations, consensus literally means a single nation can block an entire management measure for half the planet.
Half the planet.
Yeah. If one country feels a new fishing quota hurts their domestic industry, they just say no and the rule dies. What's fascinating here is that the paper explicitly points out that this leads to a lowest common denominator approach to ocean protection.
So nobody wins.
Right. You don't get the bold policy the ocean actually needs to survive. You just get the mildest, weakest policy that offends the least number of holdouts.
And if the mild policy is still too much, countries can just opt out entirely. Like, it's like leaving the group project but still taking credit for the grade while actively sabotaging the final presentation in the background.
Exactly. Which is why the experts in this study hit a wall.
Yeah.
When they sat down to identify the main challenges eroding the health of the high seas, they listed 135 specific issues.
135, that's a huge list.
It is. But the biggest, most immovable hurdles on that list weren't technological. It wasn't about, the high cost of deep-sea drones or a lack of satellite tracking. The most pressing challenges were purely political and societal.
So they were bumping up against human nature, essentially.
Precisely. Things like intense private sector lobbying for oil and mineral extraction, or just this deeply entrenched capitalist, consumptive relationship we have with the ocean.
Yeah, because for generations, the dominant mindset has just been perpetual economic growth, treating the ocean like a limitless vending machine that never asks for a coin.
That's a great way to put it. When you have a massive, broken system spanning half the globe, driven by a deeply ingrained desire to consume, just rewriting a technical rule book isn't going to work. The researchers realized they were trying to fix a software problem by swapping out the computer case. They needed to change the operating system.
And to do that, they turned to systems thinking, specifically a framework called the Iceberg Model. And I want to make sure we really visualize this because it's a brilliant way to look at how the world works. Yeah. Imagine an actual iceberg. What we see above the water is just a tiny, visible fraction of the whole thing.
Right. The events we see happening in the news right now, like the collapse of a specific fishery or a massive oil spill or forced labor on vessels, those are just the visible tip of the iceberg.
And we tend to react just to those events.
We do. But systems thinking forces you to look beneath the water. Right below the surface, you find patterns of behavior over time. Like, why do fisheries keep collapsing decade after decade?
Right. And then below those patterns, you find the system structures.
Right.
That's the consensus-based decision-making we were just talking about, or, you know, international trade laws.
Exactly. But if you go all the way to the bottom, to the deepest, most massive part of the iceberg that is actually holding the entire structure up, you find our mental models, our paradigms, the unwritten rules of society.
The core beliefs that shape everything else above them.
Yeah. And to explain how to practically change this, the researchers use something called Meadows leverage points. It's a theory of where to intervene in a complex system to cause real change.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, if you just try to change the rules or the taxes, what they call material interventions, you have very shallow leverage. It's like trimming the leaves on a weed. The deepest leverage point for systemic change is intent. You have to change the underlying mindsets and paradigms of society. The roots.
Okay, I have to push back here for a second, because if I'm a policymaker, this all sounds very beautiful, maybe a little philosophical, but I mean, isn't it a bit naive? Well, you have massive deep sea mining corporations with billion-dollar drilling rigs ready to tear up the seafloor for rare earth metals. Is simply changing our intent or telling a nice story really going to stop a billion-dollar drill? It feels a little like bringing a poem to a knife fight.
It does feel that way, yeah, and it's a critique the researchers fully anticipate. But we have to look at the mechanics of international law to understand why they are doing this. To take UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Right, the big treaty.
It's essentially the constitution for the ocean. But it was written mostly in the 1970s and 80s. It is vastly outdated. Everyone knows we need a UNCLOS 2.0. But here is the reality of systems change. As long as the underlying paradigm of global society remains, the ocean is infinite and exists solely for human extraction.
And any new convention is basically boomed.
Exactly. Any new UNCLOS convention will inevitably be drafted, debated, and manipulated to favor that exact same extraction.
Because the mining company lawyers will just find a loophole or lobby to soften the language or simply ignore it because it's the high seas and enforcement is a joke anyway.
You cannot legislate away greed if the entire system, the entire bottom of the iceberg, is built to reward it. The researchers argue that you have to flip the iceberg.
Flip the iceberg. I like that.
You have to shift that foundational mental model to a paradigm of stewardship, equity, and collective well-being before effective binding laws can even be drafted, let alone enforced. If the foundation of the house is rotten, the house will fall. You have to fix the foundation first.
Which is a monumental task. I mean, how do you even begin to flip global intent? How do you get a room full of rigid marine scientists who are used to debating, like, fish mortality rates to start rewriting the foundational beliefs of human society?
Well, they needed a tool to break these experts out of their usual habits. So they used something called the Nature Futures Framework, or the NFF. And this wasn't just made up for this paper. It was actually created by IPBES.
Let's translate that acronym for a second because it's important. IPBES is the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services.
Yes.
You can think of them as the UN's equivalent of the Avengers, but, you know, for biodiversity data.
They really are the heavy hitters of environmental policy.
Mm-hmm.
And they created the NFF as a triangular space where each of the three corners represents a fundamentally different perspective on how humans value nature.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I love this visual. Think of this NFF triangle like three different lenses on a camera. You can point your camera at the exact same stretch of the open ocean, but depending on which lens you click into place, you see a completely different version of what a perfect future looks like.
Yes, let's look through those lenses. The first corner is nature for society. This lens highlights instrumental values. It views nature primarily as natural capital.
Okay, so like a resource.
Right. The ocean is a resource to be used by humanity, but in this perfect future, it is managed with extreme sustainability and equitable distribution.
So it's very high-tech, highly efficient, heavily regulated harvesting. Okay, so if the first lens is about using nature efficiently, the second lens must be about changing our relationship to it entirely, right?
It is. The second lens is nature as culture, and this emphasizes relational values. It's about humans living in harmony and reciprocity with nature. It leans heavily into deep spiritual empathy, traditional and indigenous knowledge, and viewing humanity as merely one small part of a broader ecological family.
Less about harvesting the ocean and more about coexisting with it, which leads me to the third lens. If one is using nature and two is coexisting with nature, I'm guessing the third lens removes humans from the equation almost entirely.
Spot on. The third is nature for nature. This highlights intrinsic values. It operates on the belief that nature has a fundamental right to exist independently of human needs or human presence.
Wow.
Yeah, this lens envisions allocating massive spaces of the earth entirely to nature, completely free from human interference.
So that's three very different, very distinct utopias. And the researchers brought together these marine experts, ecologists, lawyers, policymakers, activists, and basically handed them these lenses. And they didn't just ask them to write boring policy bullet points. They asked them to write actual science fiction stories to prototype what these futures might feel like.
And that forces scientists and policymakers out of their rigid, quantitative spreadsheets. Usually in policy meetings, everyone fights over one single compromised vision of the future. But the NFF allows multiple conflicting positive visions to exist side by side.
That's a great approach.
All the participants started their stories on the same fictional research vessel, the Manta, but then the narratives diverged into three different worlds.
Okay, let's talk about the first story built on that nature for society lens where the ocean is a resource to be managed perfectly. It's called the Nemo Chronicles.
Yeah. In this future, the human-ocean relationship is completely driven by science and advanced technology. Governance isn't a patchwork of failing bodies anymore. It's managed globally out of something called One Blue Station, a state-of-the-art floating decision-making platform.
The world building here is so fun. They imagined high-speed internet universally available anywhere at sea. Commercial fishing still happens, but it's executed by highly advanced robots with absolute zero bycatch. But the plot of the story follows the crew of the Manta hunting down a notorious gene pirate named Agent Nemo.
It sounds like a summer blockbuster.
It really does.
But the policy implications hidden in the plot are brilliant. Agent Nemo steals marine genetic sequences to sell to the highest bidder, which is a real concern right now with pharmaceutical companies patenting deep sea DNA.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. To combat this in the story, this future features a universal court with absolute binding jurisdiction over the high seas.
So no more consensus-based vetoes, no more opting out of the group project.
Gone. Corporations are aggressively prosecuted. There is extreme accountability. And crucially, commercial profits from the ocean are capped by a high seas operational tax. The wealth is redistributed globally. It is still an extraction economy, but it's rigidly and technologically forced to be fair.
A highly regulated techno-utopia. Okay, let's click the second lens into place. Nature as culture. This story was called Polycultural Fractals of the Ocean, and mechanically, it is a total 180 from the centralized control of One Blue Station.
Completely different. Instead of a massive global authority, governance here is devolved to the local level. It relies on a concept called micro-sovereignty, where local communities completely control their own sustainable fishing and farming. The human-nature relationship isn't based on robotic efficiency. It's built on empathy, folklore, and spirituality.
In this story, the main character, Eirkai, lives on an artificial island called a Polynesian seastead. And they're reflecting on the life of a famous multi-species rights advocate named Adora, who happens to be a human-shark hybrid.
The inclusion of a hybrid is beautifully intentional here. It physically breaks down the barrier between human and animal, embodying those relational values. But beneath the surface of this highly spiritual story is a fascinating cutthroat economic and legal structure. Corporations in this world have been granted personhood.
Which we actually have today in many legal systems, right? Corporations are legally treated as people.
Yes, but the catch in this sci-fi future is that with personhood comes ruthless, inescapable accountability. Corporations cannot simply pay a fine and settle out of court for an oil spill. They are held criminally liable for past disasters. The punishments include the complete legal dissolution of the company or massive economic reparations for culture-related crimes.
So if your company destroys a sacred reef, your company is given the corporate equivalent of the death penalty. That is a legal mechanism that would definitely keep some modern CEOs awake at night. Now, the third lens, nature for nature. This story is called Sentient Stewards of the Sea.
This one explores a future where the high seas are essentially complete no-go areas for humans. Direct human presence is severely limited to a few floating stations dedicated solely to ecosystem restoration and carbon sequestration.
The plot of this one is fantastic. The crew of the Manta is working alongside a sentient microbe named Jeremy.
Jeremy
the microbe. Yes. And together, they have to deal with the sudden appearance of the Gaia Swarm, which is a rogue swarm of nanobots that have just decided to take ecosystem restoration into their own hands, completely ignoring human commands. But I have to ask you about Jeremy the microbe, because as amusing as a talking single-celled organism is, there is a very real, very serious legal framework hidden in that sci-fi trope, isn't there?
There absolutely is. Jeremy represents the rights of nature movement, which is gaining actual legal traction around the world today. If we connect this to the bigger picture, in this future scenario, nature itself is granted legal personhood. A new global institution is established called a convivium. And what makes the convivium radical is that it actually includes non-human representation.
Wait, how does that actually work mechanically? A dolphin can't exactly take the stand in court.
No, obviously not. It works similarly to how a corporation or a child or a trust fund has a lawyer. Human proxies, bound by strict fiduciary and ecological duties, speak on behalf of the ecosystem. So ecosystems have legal standing equal to humans, backed by an international criminal court focused exclusively on environmental crimes and ecocide.
So if a massive, faceless tech company can be considered a legal person under the law today, this future simply asks, why not a coral reef? Why not a pod of migrating whales?
Exactly. And that bridges the gap between wild, creative imagination and actual legal theory being debated right now. It forces policymakers to ask, what would happen if the ocean had its own aggressive legal defense team?
Which is an incredible thought experiment, but yeah. This brings us back to the real world and what I'm sure is the most pressing question for anyone listening. How does a workshop where scientists write stories about human-shark hybrids and rogue nanobots actually affect real-world ocean policy today? I mean, does the UN actually care about Jeremy the microbe?
They do, because of something called psychological distance. The sheer vastness and perceived remoteness of the high seas mean most people, even the policymakers writing the laws, feel entirely disconnected from it. It's thousands of miles away. It's deep underwater. It's out of sight, out of mind.
Right, because we don't feel empathy for a spreadsheet of fish stocks. You can't connect emotionally with a percentage.
Precisely. The researchers found that engaging in immersive artistic storytelling bypasses that barrier. It fosters empathy. It violently decreases the psychological distance between a legislator sitting in a sterile boardroom in Geneva and a fragile deep-sea sponge garden at the bottom of the Pacific.
It takes the abstract and makes it painfully personal.
And this has direct, immediate implications for current legal frameworks. Specifically, the real-world UN Agreement on Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, the BBNJ Treaty.
Ah, the BBNJ.
Yes. This is the new treaty the world is desperately trying to ratify to fix the holes in the old UNCLS system. We absolutely need quantitative models to predict ocean temperatures and catch limits for the BBNJ. But the researchers argue that qualitative scenarios like stories about how indigenous cultures relate to the ocean or how human empathy might evolve are required to build policies that are actually just and inclusive.
So what does this all mean for you listening to this? It means that to solve our most wicked, complex, global problems, we cannot just rely on data and technical reports. The data is essential, but data alone is not enough to change human intent. We desperately need art. We need creativity. We need radical imagination.
This raises an important question about how we communicate science in the 21st century. If we actually want the public and politicians to care about the ocean, maybe we need to stop handing them 500-page policy briefs that focus entirely on despair, collapse, and technical jargon. We need to start telling them captivating stories of hope and alternative futures. Because if we can't even imagine a transformed, sustainable future, we certainly cannot build it.
We have to write the story before we can live it. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the high seas, the iceberg model, and the undeniable power of imagination.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We've talked a lot about the middle of the ocean today, thousands of miles from where you are right now. But what if you applied the Nature Futures framework to your own backyard, or your local park, or the city block you live on? If you had to write a sci-fi story about your own neighborhood 100 years from now, which lens would you choose? Would it be a highly regulated, high-tech society optimizing natural capital? A cultural space of deep, relational harmony with the wildlife around you? Or a space given back entirely to nature? How does just imagining that future change the way you look at the trees and the concrete around you today?
When you look at the map of your own world, remember, the lines aren't fixed. The future is a wild west, and you are the one holding the pen.